It's now your turn. It's time for questions and comments, and you're welcome. There's somebody in the front row over there.
I'm very grateful to the panelists for having a very irreverent discussion. Science integrity is vital to all of us. The integrity of scientific work and the scientists who conduct this is very important. But you made exciting comments, and I'm grateful for all of that. I'm sure I speak on behalf of all the others. There is an issue now with science at the moment with the pressure which you mentioned. I think John, Sir Geoffrey Bolton mentioned this, about the pressure to publish. And this is causing a lot of distortion in science. What are the metrics for science review? Then a lot of these online journals are causing chaos everywhere. You pay a little money and you get a paper published. I'd like to refer here to the oldest legal battle, patent rights in the field of lasers, for which Charles Townes got the Nobel Prize. This is the year of the light. He passed away early this year, a great scientist in his own right. But it took nearly 40 years for Jim Gould to have his patent acknowledged as the inventor of the laser. Similarly, another great name, Millikan, and we're talking of ethics and scientific integrity, his diaries were published a few years ago, and he, let's say, filtered the data on which the publication was based, and he got the Nobel Prize. He would probably still have got the same results, but these things happen all the time. There's another thing happening, and that is the bane of many leaders of scientific research or supervisors of research who insist on every paper which is published in their department to have their own co-authorship declared. And this is a big problem, especially in the developing countries. I'd like your comments on this, please.
Thank you very much. There's somebody over there. Yep.
Peter Glackman, Chief Scientist of the University of... Chief Scientist of the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Two questions to add to that. One is, builds on, which is the whole problem of the academic CV. Unless we get to achieving a new kind, universal way of assessing academic progress, the problem of the inflated publication record and impact factor itis is going to continue to undermine confidence in science because it will drive human behaviour. That is inevitable. The second point I would raise, because this, which has not been discussed, which is an issue of for this session, of confidence in science, is the issue of conflicts of interest. We have, on one hand, a growing understanding of how to manage that between the private sector and the public sector, at least in medicine. But there are many other conflicts of interest we don't consider, particularly from activist groups, NGOs, and so forth. And again, we need to have a balanced approach to how to handle, I don't like the word conflicts of interest, I think because it's putting people off declaring their interests. And I think we need to get to a way which is less negative about people exposing what interests they have in relationship to what they do. Being a member of a advocacy group as equally conflicting, if you like, as being associated with the private sector.
Thank you, and a really important point. There was a young man in the middle there.
So I want to address how we get the public to have confidence in science, and I think this should be done through teaching kids. And here's an example. We are all confident that Earth goes around the sun. Who in this audience knows it was Copernicus who realized this? You all know Copernicus realized this, right? Who in this audience knows what was the evidence based on which Copernicus realized this? And this time I think that nobody is raising their hand because I guess most people in this audience don't know what was the evidence on which Copernicus based his claim. And this is because we just didn't teach this in schools. I think if we want kids to have confidence in science, to learn how to be confident in science, it's not enough that we tell them this guy or that guy discovered this or that. We have to tell them, look, here is the evidence. Does it look convincing to you? Here is more evidence. Now does it look convincing to you? After they see another and another and another example, this is how we gained our confidence. This is how I think they will gain confidence.
Thank you.
Sir, at the risk of being obnoxious, just one half a sentence.
Microphone.
Half a sentence. One of the things we need is a symbol like Galileo's finger. I always used to wonder, what is the origin of this sign? And Galileo's finger, which is preserved in the Florence Science Museum, is worth looking at, because science is irreverent, and this is the way to progress in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, my name is Shaker Zabada. I'm from Najah National University, Palestine. I want to speak about the data crisis, because in my opinion, as a young scientist, the time today is not comparing the time before, because now we don't have a time to make analysis data, to have a results to make correction. That's why the challenges in the future should be the smart technology directly to make analysis for data by use a machine to make correction itself. This is the challenge in the future, in my opinion. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Erha Seyaz. I'm from Sabancı University in Istanbul. And also, I'm the chair for the Scientific Advisory Committee for SESAMI, which is for which we have a session later on. I just cannot help to make a comment, and one of that comment is we have to be careful about different types of behavior that we're talking about now here in this discussion. We've talked about big data, which I think is very important, and it has something to do with data analysis, how much we understand, how much we leave it to the machines. And what actually prompted me was to hear about machines doing a lot of the analysis and giving us the results. We have to be able to interpret those results. It doesn't matter who it is. I'm also thinking about doctors getting huge amount of data, but they really still have to know how to interpret that data, how to sort of pick up what is important and what is significant. They either need to have the training, or they have to have some people who are going to produce the guidelines, and then we come also then to the laboratory where we do our experiments, what we do with our data, etc. So I think, and the pressure about evaluations, getting promotion, your job. So we have a few topics which are overlapping, but I think we also need to maybe, and they're very complex. They are influenced by many factors in the society. So maybe to simplify matters, we have to think of them a little bit separately. And also when one is doing the guidelines, we have to think about separately about handling data, because data is coming from everywhere. We have to think about handling issues that concern academic integrity when you're being promoted or when you're conducting your experiment. And then we also have to think about how to automatize these things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Panelists, so, anyone want to comment before we move to
there's a point over there before? I have a question. My name is Damon Matthews. I'm a professor in Montreal in Canada. I come here from the climate science research community, and I wanted to raise and highlight a very unique perspective that climate scientists have with public confidence in science. As many of you know, there's been a very persistent campaign of denial leveraged against climate science that ultimately has eroded public confidence in climate science in very significant ways. And we heard even this morning from one of the speakers that, you know, climate change is maybe not such a serious problem and maybe should not be given priority. And this is not consistent with the climate science, and it is, to me, far too reminiscent of this general erosion of confidence in what climate scientists are saying, that this is a, you know, fundamentally important problem that needs to be addressed at every level moving forward.
Thank you.
last point. I think that's a very important issue, that, that we saw confidence in genetic modification of plants eroded by what might be called overzealous commercial efforts to promote it against our will to have it introduced into our country in particular without being told who was being given what. But on the other side, the climate story, I think there we've seen some fairly worrying examples of good science being undermined for political ends, and I think we need to be very conscious of that. I'd like to just also pick up on the point about conflict of interest. I had an interesting experience, or I'm having an interesting experience, because one of the applications of our point of care device is pharmacogenetics, and something that we decided to pilot on is warfarin sensitivity, because we give millions of prescriptions for warfarin and we know that we can test people's sensitivity. But our British Medical Journal has said that people who have a commercial interest shouldn't be writing on it because they have a conflict of interest. And yet other people who are writing on it are advising other companies, or in my case, I also work for the National Health Service and we're worried about how much it costs for the other drugs. In other words, we all have conflicts of interest. And rather than thinking that if you have a particular commercial involvement, therefore you can't speak anymore, what we really should be doing is let's see all of your interests and not just a particular shareholding or whatever, because in that case it wasn't influencing my clinical opinion. So I think we need to be a bit broader about that issue of conflict, because you could be conflicted in terms of getting a high impact factor for your university, which is equally conflicting, and yet is often regarded as not necessary to be declared. So that, so I think that's a very important point to keep in mind.
Well, I think a lot of the really important issues have actually been thrown up very nicely by the audience. And if we've got another three hours, maybe we can have a go at them. But I'd just like to pick up one, which I think we, none of us have really alluded to, which I think was asked or posed by the lady down here in the front row. And that is that, of course, with all this data being generated, and you ask the question, well, how do we analyse this data, particularly when we have very large amounts of data from very diverse sources which relate to analogous phenomena, for instance, putting together data from the social sciences, natural sciences, medicine, and so on. And, of course, one can do that now, one should do it now, because all these things are germane in key issues. How do we make sense of the data? And the answer, quite simply, is machines make sense of it for us. But the question is, do they? Those machines make sense of the data for themselves. So if we have a very complex data set, and we're asking the question what patterns lie in the data set, and that's a fundamental scientific question, then the machine will generate the pattern for you. The question then is, does our human cognitive apparatus permit us to understand a machine-generated description of a pattern which might have 30 terms in an equation? We're used to understanding things through visual media, and actually, much of the machine analysis that now goes on is extremely difficult for normal cognitive processes to access. Someone, I think, alluded to the possibility of we don't have to worry because the machines will do it for us. Well, actually, my question would be, if we don't understand what the machine has done, if we don't understand the output the machine has created, then what is the role of the researcher in this? What's the role of the scientist anymore if we don't really understand the output? What's more, what confidence do I have in what is essentially an intellectual black box when I don't understand either what's in the box or how it's been derived? And what confidence do I have in it when I ask the question, well, who owns the box anyway, and what are their interests in owning it? And of course, this is a profound issue, because one of the things that all this big and broad data has been doing, it has generated the means whereby robots that were not very clever 20 years ago can become extremely clever. And if you ask the question, where are robots being developed now? They're not doing what we thought they would do, which is to take away from us all the rough, crude, simple, manual jobs. What's happening? They're taking away the jobs that are high-value jobs, jobs which we thought superior and well-trained managers might require. So there are a whole series of issues to do with how we, generating the genome data is fine. But that's all it is. It's data. It doesn't have any meaning until you generate meaning from it. And the question is, how do we create that meaning? How do we control it? And people have been alluding here to an open science. If we're not careful, what we could be doing is creating a closed science. But there is no such thing as public access to it, and where the public good lies is a really serious issue.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the presentations. And I introduced myself. I'm from Al-Quds University. I'm professor in community medicine and health policy. I'm Professor Khulod Dajani. You know, the theme of science and medicine and the tools of research towards health are very challenging. I want to start by talking about data and research. And unfortunately, research was more honest and more genuine. Now, what's happening in our universities, talking about the data and data analysis and quality of research. Research was a tool towards a very noble end. Now it's becoming an end. And the subjects, if we notice, are reproducible, same subject, same. If any professor is good in one subject, just they reproduce the research. If the professor wants promotion, then you notice through his career, the years before the promotion, they will produce 5, 6 regardless of the subject and so on. I don't want to say there is no such good research, but we are somehow, there's a lot of inflation in the issue of research. I don't know how can this be controlled towards a better cause. I teach comparative health systems in the world, and I want to ask Sir John, what happened to the national health system in UK? What happened to the World Health Organization about health for all and awful health? All the health systems are moving more towards privatization, towards, I understand that there is a lot of advancement in medicine and technology and so on. But the basic things shared by own, known by own, to help everybody, how can we make the balance between the right to health and education, which is a basic need for us as scientists to work for and for governments, and the industrialization and privatization of health and education, which is in the middle of what we're doing. And do we need, with the genome map and so on, how much can we interfere towards making the balance? You know, science discovers a lot and make a lot of invasions and interventions, but afterwards you discover the side effects and so on. So where is the point of equilibrium? Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's almost time to finish. There'll be private conversations afterwards. I think what we have to think about is where people can be involved directly and indirectly in science and science policy, science understanding, how we can get explanations and excitement of the scientist to the public, how we can assure that the decisions are made on the basis of experimental evidence. And remember that in medicine, less than 40% of medical treatment is science-based. The decision about GMOs in Europe specifically stated when it went to the Parliament that countries would be able to make decisions which were not science-based, and the European Parliament rejected that last week. We have to understand who makes the decisions to what science is done. Should it only be scientists? Is there a need to say the science must reflect the needs of the society in which we live? Or should it simply be, we need to know, we need to understand? These are issues, frankly, which we don't often discuss. It's left to the research councils. It's left to some of the parliamentarians who are making decisions which are not based on any logical criterion. So really, we need to be open about what can be done, what should be done, and if it's done, who's funding it and why? Because those are the issues which result in our acceptance or lack of acceptance of what is done in science and what is commercialized from science. Thanks ever so much for what I've felt is a really interesting debate. Thank you.